I must finish at 7:15, right?
Yeah, that would be great if possible.
Yeah.
You can run over as we're a little bit late, you can run a little bit later too.
Okay,
Thank you.
thank you for the opportunity to share with you what I am working on these days. I work on the sufficiency concept, which is not a new concept. Its roots go back to the Greek civilization for us, but we do find sufficiency in almost all civilizations. And what sufficiency does is it questions the mainstream economics and policies, and it shifts. If we shift towards sufficiency economy, this means that we will shift from the mainstream economics to physics-inspired economics, which is something there are researchers who started working on embedding physics in economics, but not necessarily with the links to policies. So maybe first thing is, as I know that plenty of people are not familiar with the concept of sufficiency. So look at just this figure. Sufficiency is where philosophy and several scientific discipline theories developed in philosophy and several scientific disciplines meet. In philosophy, sufficiency is described as distributive justice theory based on equity. In social science and in political science, as an organizing principle of societies, and an organizing principle where the most closest to us is democracies. So sufficiency is about democracy. Why? Because it's about equity. And from anthropology and psychology, it's about human well-beings, human needs, and human well-being. But the human well-being that is considered is not the hedonic well-being, which is the individualistic version of the well-being. It's more the societal well-being, and this is where it joins at the same time the principle of societal organization, democracies, and equity. And what does that mean from economics perspective? It means actually embedding physics in economics with the objective of satisfying human needs within the planetary boundaries. Because if sufficiency would be considered, so the overshoot of planetary boundaries would be taken more seriously by in economic policies. By combining what I was able to find about sufficiency in all these disciplines and other disciplines as well, I did end up with this definition of sufficiency. So, from political science and political and social science, we understand that sufficiency is a set of policy measures and daily practices. So, it's not about behavior of individuals; it's about daily practices. The main difference between the two is that sufficiency recognizes that as individuals, we are locked in, for example, the infrastructures that we have. Good illustration of this is the shift that we see in our cities towards biking, because today we do have the infrastructure to bike. So it's not behavior change. It is first having the infrastructure that allows us to use different ways for different solutions for our mobility. But to arrive to these infrastructures, you must have the right majority, actually. And that's why it's a democratic issue. From environmental perspective, what these policies and daily practices do is that they avoid upfront the demand for all natural resources and not just energy, as sufficiency has been understood so far in France and Germany. It's about all natural resources, because each time we use any other natural resources than energy, we always need energy to extract, transform, and use the other natural resources. And then from philosophy and psychology and anthropology, this is what we have. From philosophy, what we learn is that sufficiency has two corridors. It has a lower limit, which is the well-being for all, and the upper limit, which is the planetary boundaries. Philosophers do not define the lower and the upper limit. From philosophers, what we learn is that sufficiency has these two limits. And then what I did was I did find in, for example, the planetary boundaries comes from Earth system science, and the well-being for all comes from social science, from political science, science as well from different disciplines. And this is why I propose to consider well-being for all as a lower limit and planetary boundaries as an upper limit. This definition ended in the IPCC mitigation report, but also in synthesis report of the sixth cycle of the IPCC. Now, what does sufficiency, what does physics could do, how sufficiency links to physics? The simple way to explain sufficiency through physics is about considering sufficiency is about policies that are based on the first and the second principle of thermodynamics, which is not the case today in our policies. In mainstream economics, entropy is ignored, completely ignored. And in mainstream economics, the main it's all based on a perfect world. It's based on a world that does not exist, actually. While by embedding physics in economics, we can take into account the real world, what's happening in the real world. And the real world is much more complex than the linear interactions that we are able that we learn to model in mainstream economics. And in the real world, actually, there is no rational behavior because there are plenty of uncertainties that makes us behaving in one way or another. And in the real world is much more complex, but it is able to adapt, which is not the case in the mainstream economics. So some examples, I will give you in the following slide some examples of how physics helps us in anticipating and in designing economic policies that could deliver on well-being for all within planetary boundaries, which is what sufficiency is about. So a few examples that happened that are that we know that are the most recent ones. For example, the 2008 financial crisis. There are different ways to assess it, and if you try to apply to the crisis to assess the crisis using principles from physics, and then this allows to have better recognizing the earlier the system. The systemic risk that is that exists with any system, because there is no perfect market, there is no perfect system. That's why it exists. And based on these assessments, the consequence of that is to improve the financial regulations to be able to mitigate the early risk and to avoid these risks. Another good example that I like is the one related to income inequalities. Income inequality is based on its power dynamics. Actually, and this is something we understand very well in physics. And when you understand this in physics, when you apply physics to income inequality, then you end up with the proposing economic policies that are based on progressive taxation of wealth to eliminate extreme inequality and to eliminate poverty. We don't need to today. What we have is to try to mitigate, which is different from eliminating, while what we should be doing, what physics allows us to do by considering principles of physics in the design of economic policies, is to eliminate completely extreme inequality and poverty. Another important example is what is happening today from sustainability perspective. We know that we are going to overshoot, that is, we are likely to overshoot the 1.5 degree target, and most likely the same for the 2 degrees target. We have already overshooten 6 out of the 9 planetary boundaries, and each time we overshoot planetary boundaries, so this means that we are in a risky zone. A risky zone is a zone where we don't know exactly how the Earth system is going to react. This means that we cannot anticipate our responses to that. However, if we would consider economic entropy, if we would consider the second principle of thermodynamics, then we would avoid overshooting the planetary boundaries. If I give you an example about climate change issues, so today the implementation or the pseudo implementation of the Paris Agreement is about setting carbon or climate neutrality targets without considering the limitation, the physical limitation of the planet. So our target, for example, the European target is for 2050. It does not take into account the fact that the remaining carbon budget does not allow us to plan for 2050 carbon neutrality target. When you consider that the remaining carbon budget is what it is a constraint. The starting point is the physical constraint. It's like if you are sick, so you have physical constraints, you cannot stand up, go to work. If you consider this as a starting point, and then you go to what does that mean for us to take into account this physical constraint, then you end up with carbon neutrality, carbon zero carbon for Europe around 2030, which is not the case at all, which is out of the design of policies, climate policies that we have today. And then from there, you can scale up and see how to do that for different sectors, etc. This is the economic entropy, actually, in the case of climate change, and it is likely to be the case for other planetary boundaries on which I don't work. I work mainly on the climate change one, a little bit on the land one, because it's directly linked to the climate change one. It's also about equity, because it's an equity vis-à-vis of the future generations, but it's also about north-south equity, and for us taking responsibility, because a kid born in Paris is a kid born with climate debt, because he is just because he's born in Paris. It's like that, compared to a kid born in Dakar, for example. And the fact that today we do not take into account the constraint, the physical constraint that we have in the mainstream economics, we don't take into account this. While if we would have physics-inspired economics, then the starting point will be the constraint. And in this case, I am a little bit extrapolating. I don't have the full evidence yet built for that. So in this case, if we would be living in a world of equity, and a world of equity, north-south equity, is a world without wars. And instead of investing in wars, we would invest in how to restore nature to allow to ensure that our kids will have a livable planet. Or in other words, is to ensure that we will be ancestors. Because now the real question for us is the fact that it is unlikely that our generations will be ancestors, given the climate and the ecological polycrisis. Thank you for your attention.
Wow, thank you so much. That absolutely blew me away. That was brilliant. We have quite a few minutes now for some discussion and some questions. So please, if you do, I welcome you to raise your hands.
Otherwise, you can develop further on sufficiency. Yeah? I try to be short, just to be on time.
Yeah, if you have more to say, please do go ahead.
Oh yeah, I have much more. Actually, I have to simplify. So, as I mentioned earlier, sufficiency is not a new concept. However, sufficiency is not in our policies. France is the only OECD country where sufficiency is mentioned in the energy transition law from 2015. However, we don't have any decree to implement sufficiency measures. We have the opposite. We have plenty. I identified in the French law, plenty of decrees, implementation decrees that go against sufficiency. Actually, it goes in the other direction. Why? Because sufficiency questions the mainstream economics, and it also questions the way we do policies. So if I am French, so if we consider the French case, France is very much a top-down democracy. It's not mixed with a bottom-up. It's not like Switzerland, for example. So all the decisions, the most important election in France is the presidential election, and then all the decisions are top down. While if we would be in a democratic regime, in a sufficiency based approach to design our policies, in this case, we will have a more citizens' approach would be more taken into account. So I give you an example from we had a climate citizen assembly in France following. It's an interesting story because we had first a carbon tax for vehicles, for individual cars. This puts at risk of poverty those who are the lowest middle class, the first, second decides, the second, third decides. And then, so the reaction was to this law was the Yellow Vest movement. And an answer, the political answer to the Yellow Vest movement in France in 2018, 2019 was to have to organize citizens' assembly and to organize a system where we were able to complain, to write our complaints as citizens. So these complaints have not been taken into account at all. But if we focus on the citizens' assembly, what happened was that a group of 150 people were selected randomly. They have been meeting several times, and then they made proposals, policy proposals to the government. Originally, when the president, French president, made the proposal for the for when he agreed on the assembly, the climate assemblies, it was to take into account what citizens would be proposing. But when they did come up with their proposals, he did not take into account what they proposed. So you see, the citizens' engagement. There is nothing in the French system as it is today with the constitution that we have for to take. There is no obligation to take into account citizens' proposals, and this is why it is failure. So as a result of that, we are now in a very bad economy political situation, as you know. And if we would have had what was interesting in the proposals made by the climate citizen assembly in France is the fact that they made a proposal, for example, to make energy renovation mandatory. Today, energy renovation is voluntary, based in if you would like to do it. And energy renovation, as it is today, we have plenty of public finance. That is mainly those who can benefit from this public finance are starting from the fourth, fifth decile, because you must pay. You must have a bit of savings to be able to pay for that. So the low income, so it exacerbates the existing inequalities, basically. And what was interesting, each time I have been working on energy innovation for a while, and each time I said that the only way to make it happen is to make it mandatory, the reaction has always been, this is a Soviet Union type of policies. But actually, the Citizen Assembly, they did come up with proposal to make it mandatory. Because when you citizen, well-informed citizen, is a citizen who will work about his or her well-being, not the profit of the industry. And while the policies today in the mainstream economics are based on the information provided by the industry, and the only objective, the main objective is growth and competition, while sufficiency is about the opposite. It's about the starting point for sufficiency is the well-being for all, it's equity within planetary boundaries. And while mainstream economics does not take into account at all physics, the Earth system limitations.
Brilliant, yes, thank you. Thank you for expanding on that. Once again, we have a few more minutes for questions or comments if people have, opinions or I see that there's a note in the comments. I don't know if you can see it, Yamina, that says thank you for this very powerful presentation.
Thank you.
Anyone in the audience? Okay, please don't be shy. So what I will say is I think that this is a really important thing to take into account and think about as we also put this structure into, or try to put this structure into the way we work too. So it'd be interesting how we can talk about sufficiency within the world of high energy physics. I see a hand up, Jan.
Yes, thank you, Amina, for this inspiring talk. You have given examples of things that have happened, for instance, in France, and I've heard of other countries trying things and then being fully ignored, as usual, by the higher powers. And do you have a proposal of how we could go ahead and actually make our governments do the right thing? Because apparently, even when we try and propose good things, we fail to make them deliver on it.
So that's a very good question. What we are working on now, so we did set up with colleagues the World Sufficiency Lab to see how to embed, with the objective to embed sufficiency policies in the EU policy framework. Our major conclusion today, we will have a report that we are launching in June, Sufficiency Gap Report, is that to have sufficiency happening in France or Germany or whatsoever, any EU country, we must have sufficiency in EU policies, in EU law, and this means that we need to modify the EU treaty. So we are locked in. Because without modification of the EU treaty, it's not going to be, it will be a joke. I give you an example. What people do not know, most people do not know, is that, for example, the climate law in Europe, the climate law is not in the primary legislation. It's secondary legislation. And because it is secondary legislation, this means that the backlash that we are experiencing now, they can change the climate law. If it's not written in the primary, because primary legislation is like the constitution. So we must have it in the constitution. And instead of working to have it in 27 constitutions, especially given that it's we are not at the same level of understanding and discussing sufficiency, France and Germany, France is an exception, followed by Germany and to some extent Switzerland. That's why the EU framework or the EU law would be the best way to do it. And then what we are doing, what we are aiming for at the Sufficiency Lab is to have as many ambassadors as possible on sufficiency. So we will provide trainings starting from September on sufficiency to ensure that there is good understanding, because in France it is discussed, but it is misunderstood. In Germany, it's the same story. Then we need to fight for it, because for me, fighting for it is fighting for life in the planet, fighting for a livable planet for our kids. This is what it means for me. So it's not just doing research for research. It's doing research for policymakers, and this is what I have always done since my PhD, is much more challenging than just doing research for research. For me, it's much more easier to go to a researchers conference than to go to explain to a policymaker why it's beneficial for him to embed sufficiency. And the way we explain that, so sufficiency was understood in France and Germany as energy sufficiency only. But actually, in our report, we show sufficiency is not just about energy. And in our report, what we show is that sufficiency is soft power, because today the debate is about soft power in the EU. We must be realistic. We must, if you'd like to have the ears of policymakers, you must talk their language. Otherwise, use their words. So if you can connect your work, and this is what we're trying to do, connect what we understand from sufficiency to the priorities of our governments, we think that we could be successful. However, we need to have as many ambassadors as possible in all forums, universities, everywhere. So there is no something magic that we can do just to have it like that. Sorry, and I'm sorry for our kids. Yes, Christina.
Thank you.
If I have time to add a question related to this one.
Yeah.
So again, on the idea of practical advice for what we can do to mitigate climate crisis to get worse. I think it's very important that the lab and the work that you're doing are looking into these things and how we can inform politicians on doing things. So my question is, given that, for example, in France, the government is more willing to be influenced by industry needs Did you and your team look into how we could influence industry into realizing also the economical impact that the climate crisis has so that policies could be informed, let's say, via the means of the industry requesting these things?
Exactly what we are trying to do. And the first sector that we will tackle, I come from the building sector, is the housing industry or the building the construction industry in France and in the EU. Because now, as you know, we do have a commissioner for housing and energy. Now we do have a recognition that we do have a housing crisis. Having housing crisis does not necessarily mean building. We need to build new square meters. There are plenty of places in Western Europe specifically where there is no need to build new square meters. We need to find a way, the legal way, to use the existing square meters that are already built, either for vacant housing or vacant non-residential buildings. And for this, you need a political process. And then you need a legal process there. And given that now we do have a commissioner for housing and energy, although at this stage, again, we come back to the first law, we must, I think, reopen the EU treaty because housing is not shared responsibility between the EU and the member state. It has been so far, based on the treaty, it's only member state who can act on housing, and that's why it is only the discussion with the industry is taking place mainly at the member state level. But yes, we will be doing that. We'll start with the housing sector, then we'll see based on the resources if we could expand, and we will learn by doing this for housing.
Okay,
Thank
thank
you.
you.
Thank you so much for that. And once again, Yamina, thank you so much for your talk. That was absolutely fantastic. Very eye-opening and shows us what we really need to be working on. So with that, I'd like to
You
thank you.
must,
Sorry.
sorry, I must leave you now
Yes, of
because I
course.
have my son. It's the bath time now. Bye-bye.
Of course. Thank you so much. A round of applause from everyone. Unfortunately, she cannot see our virtual round of applause, but it's still there. It's recorded. It officially happened. So with that, I would like to welcome everyone to take a let's say a 15. Well, we need to get going at 30. So let's say a 12-minute break. Please stretch your legs. Perhaps go look away from the screen. Don't start looking at your phone for the next 12 minutes. Maybe look at the sunset or sunrise.